Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action. That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today. The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
Welcome to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Samantha Schroeder, Deputy Director of FedSoc Films. Today's episode is inspired by our recent film, Madison and the Fight for the Constitution, a short documentary film on how James Madison wrote a new nation into existence and, through a great compromise, the Bill of Rights, unified the people behind ideals that would change the course of history. But today, we're focusing on the woman behind James, Dolly Madison. Our guest today is Dr. Catherine Alger, president of the Massachusetts Historical Society. Her book authorship includes Parlor Politics, in which the ladies of Washington helped build a city and a government, A Perfect Union, Dolly Madison and the Creation of the American Nation, Dolly Madison, The Problem of National Unity, and The Queen of America, Mary Cutts, Life of Dolly Madison. Welcome to the show, Dr. Alger.
I'm so pleased to be here. Thank you for having me.
So the last book title I read is intriguing. Why was Dolly referred to as the Queen of America, given that America just rejected monarchy?
Well. You put your finger right on it. If it's okay with you, I'd like to give a little background to our conversation because
sure.
I'm so interested in the way that you talked about James Madison writing a new nation into existence. And at this time, he doesn't actually know Dolly, but Dolly and her cohort, that is elite white women of her era, had a very special relationship to the work that James Madison and the other founders were doing. And what I mean by that is by writing a new nation into existence, the founders were proposing to run a government with a theory. And that theory was called republicanism. We call it small r republicanism because it's not the same as the Republican Party, which is a different thing. But this is a political theory. And as all of you good Hamilton watchers know, for the founders, this was not just a revolution, but it was a chance to, as they would say, make the world anew. The world turned upside down, right? So this theory was going to make a government that was brand new, unlike anything else that had gone before. But putting this into practice on the ground was really the job, as I said, of Dolly Madison and her colleagues in Washington City and the other capitals of the U.S. And you were right that in this theory, there is a rejection of everything monarchical. Right? So no courtiers, no patronage, no material display, no royalty. This is all sounding good, I think, Samantha, you'll agree with me. But there was a problem. And the problem was for the founders and for these new American citizens, the only vocabulary of power that they had lay in aristocracy and royalty. And so it's one thing to have a great revolution and then you got to rule. So really, right from the start, the founding generation, the men and women of it, had an uneasy relationship with royalty, monarchy, and aristocracy. They realized they needed some of that to actually rule over these citizens and these new citizens, and also to gain legitimacy in the eyes of their European counterparts. And so we have these weird moments at the beginning of the Republican experiment, where John Adams, you know, who's railing against the monarch and King George, starts arguing that maybe we should have titles, like maybe we should call the president His Serene Highness and he should be Lord Adams. We have these moments where George Washington is wondering how many pairs of matched horses should he have to take his carriage through the streets of Philadelphia. I mean, how much is too much, but you need enough horses, you know, to make a statement. By the way, the answer, Samantha, is three. I think it was three he decided.
Good to know.
Good to know. It's always good to know. But they're making these weird decisions. And what ends up happening, and this is through like the beginning of the Republic, George Washington's administration, and certainly by the time Dolly comes to town, is this uneasy tension becomes gendered. So that the women of the founding era take on the mantle of aristocracy. And so they're the ones who dress in fabulous clothes. We call Washington Mr. President, but we called her Lady Washington. James Madison is Mr. President, but Dolly is regularly called Queen Dolly or Lady Dolly. And so they're the ones that supply to the American public and to the European watchers. They supply this imprimatur of aristocracy, of power and legitimacy. And that's the long answer to your question.
So yeah, it's interesting because, you know, giving the wife of a new political leader who is not a monarch any sort of title or prestige sounds like a little bit like you're flirting with, you know, the monarchy or aristocracy. When did Dolly come to town?
So she starts actually in 1801. She comes with her fairly brand new husband, not too brand new, but in 1801, James Madison is asked by Thomas Jefferson to be his Secretary of State. So she's in town from 1801 to 1808 when her husband is elected. So by the time she and James leave, they've been in that town for 16 years. And what's interesting to me is that when Dolly Madison hits town, she immediately starts the kind of work that she is going to do as First Lady. So she immediately gets a house. It's on F Street. And she starts making it into a place for social and political interactions. And she creates really a rudimentary political machine in early Washington City. And so by the time the election of 1808 comes around, everybody's dying for James Madison to win the presidency so that Dolly will bring those connections and that political network into what would become, under her tenure, known as the White House.
Given the time that they were, you know, living and leading in, why would a woman, especially in a new nation, again, moving away from aristocracy, monarchy, why would a woman be given such a powerful role in politics?
Well, I wouldn't say she was given it. I think it was a necessity. So here's a spoiler alert. This theory of republicanism that they're going to build a government on, it's not going to work. And by the 1820s, we are going to emerge as a nation with two parties, a democracy, not a republic, with a strong president. This is not at all what the founders intended. But the truth is what they intended was just not going to work. Politics needs to happen. And here's a great example of sort of how this worked out. One of the topics of the bad old days of the monarch, the royal court, that absolutely obsessed the founders was patronage. And Samantha, I can't believe I'm actually defining patronage for your audience, but I will. And patronage is the awarding of money, titles, land, or other perks given to one's supporters. Well, to the founders, this was the essence of corruption, the cesspool of corruption. I think Thomas Jefferson wrote more about the dangers of patronage than almost anything else. So, of course, in this new world, there's not going to be patronage. It's not going to be courtiers. They're not going to be women like they have in Europe running around getting jobs for their husbands. But as it turns out, you kind of need patronage. You sort of need to, when you're elected president, you need to have people around you that, you know, kind of like are on your side. And if you don't have that, like poor John Adams, you're really doomed to fail. And you do need to offer your supporters a little something. I mean, a little quid pro quo. But again, the founding men are in a terrible position. They can't do any of this stuff that they've railed against. So in the vacuum of that, wives stepped in. And so one of the activities that I found fascinating about Dolly Madison, and again, this generation of ruling women, is that they run these patronage machines because they're rewarding supporters, they're rewarding constituents, they're creating networks for their husbands. But if you didn't know to look at what women were doing and working and saying, you would never know that there is a patronage machine. And I'll say this, a lot of what these women did, so I guess really the big story that Dolly and her cohort create an alternative political structure in Washington where things get done. In the 1820s, when this whole thing's going to fall apart, as I spoiled earlier for you, there's actually a fairly easy transition to this two-party democracy and this political party system, which is going to count. And that's because these women had done that work. So one of the hallmarks of republicanism, and Samantha, when I tell you this, you're going to realize why this is not going to work. One of the ruling ideas of republicanism is this idea of virtue. And what they meant by that was very specific. And virtue was the elevation of the common good over one's own interest. So the idea behind a republic, just because you can't believe you're hearing this, I know.
Virtue in Washington. Tell me more.
and again, a particular kind of virtue, meaning that, you know, if running the sheep through the common ground actually takes away money out of my pocket, but my goodness, it's good for the town, I should give up my own interest and go work for the common good. That's not going to really work. And I'm going to put this in the most optimistic way. It's not everybody agrees on what the common good is. So right. A lot of that fighting that you see again in Hamilton, or that dueling that you've heard about in the early Republic, comes because these people believe there's one common good and everybody should be working for it. The problem is there's two groups of people who believe that. And the fact that there are two groups of people means that the other group, whoever you're not part of, is a deadly enemy and a traitor in a one-party system. Mm-hmm. So what the women of Washington were doing in the early 1800s up till the 1820s, and again, they're not really conscious of it. They're not, there's no diabolical plot here. They're actually setting the nation up for a two-party system.
Hmm. Wow.
And then by the 1830s, that becomes institutionalized. And same thing with patronage, by the way. Again, that's all kind of privately done, but at some point that patronage system is going to be institutionalized. So a lot of this work that these early women do become just part of our political system.
When you say patronage system, what do you mean by that? Because it sounds like what they're doing is what is always happening in Washington. You have women in power politics, wives of famous men, whether it's, you know, politics or industry leaders, captains of industry, hosting salon evenings. And in Washington, a city where ideas, you know, it's fueled by ideas, it doesn't sound like such a dangerous thing to have, you know, a first lady or the wife of the Secretary of State hosting foreign leaders or national leaders to have conversations over wine.
You would make a terrible Republican, Samantha. Terrible. Because, you know, you're absolutely right. These are old world ideas. I mean, if you think about mm-hmm. courts and courtiers and the power of women. But for instance, Thomas Jefferson, who spent a lot of time in Paris, saw that mm-hmm. dynamic that you're talking about, and he hated it. He loathed what he called unofficial characters in politics. And by that, he meant sort of this courtier figure, but also women. And he saw women at social events working the room and getting positions for their husbands or influencing what we would think of as policy kinds of things, and he hated it. He and his fellow founders thought it all should be in this, all contained in this very transparent official sphere of, you know, Senate, House of Representatives, public statements. But that's not how things work. And I love that you mentioned wine because this is what we call the unofficial sphere. So for politics to work, you need that official sphere. You need things to happen. You need press releases and declarations and legislation and all that stuff. But you also need this other sphere that it's easy to call the social sphere. I tend not to do that because it sounds, I don't know, sort of soft. But right. The unofficial sphere, which does happen at social events and in people's homes, is a place for process. It's for negotiation, for proposals. It's a place to you know, maybe offer a suggestion or a thought, or even turn something down in a way that can be deflected through wine and dancing yeah. and candlelight and music. And you need both of those spheres. And what the founders were uncomfortable with were those candlelit tables with the wine, and they wanted to get rid of them. And without, again, not without a big grand plan, but the women of the founding generation just put them back in. And that's how that really stabilized the federal government and the nation in those very crucial early years.
Sounded very idealistic and also strange given Jefferson's inclination to wine, especially French wine. Thinking about, you know, your work, yeah, you work 9 to 5, whatever, at your job. You know, you have your professional office environment, but think of how many, you know, serendipitous moments. Think of how many things happen outside of work, whether it's happy hour, a private dinner, getting together in a more casual environment with your coworkers, you know, that you could never force or create in this, you know, structured professional environment. And so it's interesting to see that that was Jefferson's take on that.
And you know, it's interesting, you're saying that, and you're speaking as a modern person. I totally understand what you're talking about. I enjoy a happy hour myself, and so will our listeners. But this is also happening. What it makes even more remarkable is that this is happening at a time before work and your personal life get very segmented. The kind of like, I think of the Mad Men, Don Draper, where the husband goes away from the home into the city center to conduct business while the women are left in the suburbs of whatever. That doesn't happen in the 19th century or in the 18th century, surely. And that's another way to understand sort of houses. So in those days, a house like Monticello, but any town would always have a house where the leading family would live. This is where they would live and, you know, have meals and family life, but it was also a place of business. So if you came into town and you were an inventor or a preacher or prominent person, you would go to that house. And so the home itself was not just a place of leisure or relaxation the way we think of our homes. They were actually sites of business. But let me just say something about Jefferson. This may help a little bit with your confusion, where he both knows the importance of these things and yet denies them. He's very famous superficially for his, quote, dinner parties that are, you know, supposed to be very sociable. And they've been presented by historians as a kind of Virginia hospitality. They were not. They were Jefferson trying to harness the power of the social event, but in a really kind of controlling way. So he did have dinner parties at what was called the Executive Mansion, but he invited only members of one party or the other because he was not interested in power sharing. He was not interested in building a ruling class. He was interested either in rallying his troops, you know, the Democratic Republicans, or keeping an eye on the Federalists. And he would make sure they were small, which again, some historians have interpreted this as a kind of intimate, let's get together. No, it was because he wanted to control that conversation. And so he was trying to sort of use social events in the way that you're acknowledging, but he was an absolute control freak about it. At the same time, so this is like between 1801 until he leaves in 1808, Dolly Madison over in the house on F Street is throwing dinner parties all the time. So Jefferson only does this a couple times a year. So if you're a congressperson, you might get to go to the Executive Mansion like once a season. She's doing parties and teas and dinners, and she's inviting everybody who comes to town, people from both parties. So the kind of political work that you'd want in a new nation, which is where everybody's getting to know each other, building the bonds that you're talking about, sharing interests, getting to know the enemy, not as an enemy, but as another person, attaching to each other, attaching to the town. All of that's happening in the house on F Street. It's not happening at Jefferson's house.
Very interesting. What did James think of his wife's salon evenings and total socialite status?
Well, one of the things you have to understand about doing history, Samantha, is nobody ever talks about what you really want them to talk about. So we don't have a lot of direct attachment to that. What I think is true is that James Madison appreciated what Dolly did. Their styles were very, very different. He was the cerebral kind of introverted guy, but he appreciated what she did. And I can say that too, because I study another very good example of this dynamic, John Quincy Adams and his wife and political partner, Louisa Catherine Adams. She was a total Dolly. And gosh, John Quincy was so conflicted about it because he loved that she kind of like got him elected president, but he kind of hated what he had to do to get there, you know. So his conflict shows us that they are conscious of it. But I'll say this, and of course, this is ironically in a very theoretical way. James was very concerned with issues of attachment, psychological attachment, and the problem of unity. So the new nation, this new America that came out of the Revolutionary War, it had a problem with attachment to power. There was no attachment. There was no feeling. People at that time didn't even think of themselves as being part of one nation. So it's funny how language points an arrow sometimes. This was an era where people used the plural when they talked about the United States of America. So they'd say, the United States of America are blank, not is.
Interesting.
Or people would talk about their own state as their country. So Jefferson's famously talks about my country. He meant Virginia. This is bad, by the way. Everybody knew that there needed to be unity. There needed to be attachment. And James worried about this. These psychological bonds, he said, you know, one of the things that drew people together is a shared history or a shared bloodline. We don't even have that. We're too new to have history. He called it veneration, right? You venerated your country. And so all I can say is that if you look through the lens of unity, if you say that Dolly Madison acted, and she would have understood this, in her husband's goals, everything she did was toward bringing people together, whether it was literally bringing people together in a room, right, or figuratively becoming a figurehead for the administration, all of her actions are toward unity, which was exactly what James's goal was.
On the note of unity, given one of the titles of your books, what was the problem of national unity, and why write a book on this topic?
The problem with unity, I think, is it really was this idea that there were 13 colonies that saw themselves as just unconnected in any way. And there were a lot of differences that people perceived. And in the kind of their understanding of regional differences, they almost saw these regional differences as innate, biological, so that Southerners were hot-blooded and impatient, and New Englanders were phlegmatic and thrifty, which I'm not saying isn't true, by the way, but they almost saw it as a problem of blood. And
how European of them.
How European of them. Well, that's who they are, right? And so in the capital, like, there's these great stories of, you know, men, and they would be men, coming from all over the country who had been elected a representative or a senator, who were just so different from each other, especially the ones that came from the backwoods. So they were representative of, again, this spectrum where there's these 13 colonies, and how are we ever going to draw together and come together? So it is no wonder that James worried about this, and why he was determined, for instance, during the War of 1812, not to abuse his constitutional powers, because he wanted to make sure that we were moving together as a nation. And it's interesting that, again, Dolly Madison will have been on the job, if you will, for about 12 years before the War of 1812. And it's all of her work toward unity that's going to help sustain the capital through that very difficult period.
So in our film, we talk about how James Madison shaped the government on paper. How did the ladies of Washington, namely Dolly, help build a new government? What was their role in the founding of America?
So, and I like to call Dolly the first lady, and I apologize to all scholars and fans of Martha Washington and Abigail Adams, but in some ways, in her work, I'm going to address what you just asked, but she's also at the same time shaping what we understand to be the role of the first lady. And one of those aspects is her relationship to the executive mansion, the House, which we now think of as just a first lady thing. But remembering that houses, big houses, grand houses, gentry houses, like they were in Europe, were not just places of leisure and relaxation, but they were nodes of business. They were the center, the means of production of politics, if you will. They were the province of men. So this is why you have someone like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson involving themselves so much in the creation of their houses. They're picking out paint colors and wallpaper because they're creating a power structure. So the idea, when the Madisons ascend to the executive mansion, the idea that James turns this over to Dolly is not just because she's a woman, because women didn't necessarily do that. It shows that he was placing an enormous amount of trust in what she was about to do. And what she did was she took an executive mansion that purposely under Jefferson was isolated, where nobody came. Jefferson put because Jefferson feared women and the power of social events, he put the kibosh on all social events except for a 4th of July and a New Year's reception. And he just had these little dinner parties. She took this house and she's like, we're changing this. So she engaged Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who's a great architect. And they, well, I guess people say she redecorated the house. She restructured the house And again, not for like lovely kitchens or bathrooms like House Hunters. She constructed these wonderful rooms for entertaining. And it's hard to imagine, but before Dolly's executive mansion, there was no one place in Washington where everybody could get together. And by everybody, wow. There was no one place where all the male members of government could get together, let alone travelers, diplomats, and everybody's family. So she creates this one place where everybody can get together. And then she decides to throw these soirees, Mrs. Madison's Wednesday nights, which become a regular fixture on the political calendar. So now we've got this place where everybody can come together. We've got this one day a week where you, if you need to get something done, you need to meet somebody, you need to make, you know, make a plan, you know where to come. And she invites everybody to do their own politics. So even as Jefferson was controlling that conversation at the dinner party, Dolly's just opening it up for everyone to get together.
How democratic of her.
Yes. And she got in trouble for that too. People hate, because some people, yeah, Democrat. It's one of those things, democracy was could have considered rule by the mob at that point. So it was not a great thing to say, though some people are starting to use it in that very affirming way. But another thing that was happening, well, and because it was a social event ruled over by this lovely, gracious woman, everybody had to be on their best behavior. So all that stuff you saw in Hamilton was not going to do at Dolly's drawing room. And the other thing that was happening that was more subtle, but in some ways more important, is that these people were beginning to build a ruling class. So we needed a ruling class of people of both parties. They began to see each other as humans. They began working together. And so really, when you talk about going back to your question, the building of the government in that house using social events, Dolly, and again, this is not a conspiracy, she's building a ruling class and she's building the foundations of government.
Dolly sounds like she's taking domestic goddess to the next level.
So you asked me about a possible title for our podcast. I would not say domestic goddess. But I would, if I may propose, and this is another kind of function that she carves out for our government, I would love to propose the idea of the Republican Queen.
Ooh, the Republican Queen. That sounds even more fabulous. So I want to take a pause here and paint a picture for our listeners who might not know. They might not have gone to Monticello, Montpelier, or the Dolly Madison House, all three of which I've been to many times. Huge fan. So when we're talking about Jefferson's home, Monticello, and Madison's home, Montpelier, those homes are hundreds of miles outside of Washington. And I would imagine take many days or a day or so to get to by carriage. When we're talking about Dolly Madison's home, we're talking about a home that is a block from the White House. How big of a deal was that at the time?
Oh, you're talking about the lovely yellow building on Lafayette Square.
Yeah. Is that the Dolly Madison home we're talking about?
Well, it depends. It's from a different era in Dolly's life. So Dolly Madison and James Madison depart in 1817 after he's shepherded the nation through the war. And they depart in a golden glow of success. And part of this, you may wonder why they had a golden glow. It's because the unity of the nation held. And the reason they left in 1817, they lost, obviously they didn't run in the election of 1816. There were so many parties and people wanted to pay both Dolly and James so much homage. So they go off, as you say, many carriage rides to Montpelier and basically stay there for 20 years. So, Dolly Madison did not go back to Washington for 20 years. James preferred to stay in the Virginia countryside. He died in 1836, so about, again, 20 years later. And then, I don't want to use the phrase bad out of hell, but she was not a country girl, Dolly. She was not a country girl. So she starts, you know, visiting Washington, and then pretty soon she moves to Washington. And that's when she moves in to that beautiful yellow house, which I think is the home of the federal judiciary now, but you'll correct me if I'm wrong, on Lafayette Square, as you say, the center of the action. And she enters this really interesting moment in her life where she becomes what they called a relic of the Republic. Now, part of that is a little creepy because widows were called relicts, as though you were like left over. Once your husband died, you're basically just a relic. But the idea was that she was one of the last surviving members of the founding generation. In fact, I almost called my book The Last of the Founders. There she was. And she becomes this figurehead of great honor. Now, she's really poor at this time in her life, and she cannot afford new clothes. And let me just tell you something. She loved clothes, so she would have definitely bought new clothes if she could. But what she had was all of her lovely clothes she had from when she was the first lady. So it only kind of added to her allure and mystique. You saw this, you know, white-haired lady with the brilliant blue eyes, dressed in, you know, fashions from the early 1800s. It's no wonder that every president, all the way, I think, through Tyler, you know, walked across Lafayette Square to get her blessing. And, you know, people honored her in all kinds of ways, and they struck a coin for her, and they gave her own seat on the House of Representatives on the floor. And she became this icon of Americanness at this moment in her career. So she stays in Washington until she dies in 1849, I believe. And she becomes this great figurehead in Washington. America's first widow. And honey, just because she just lasted for so long, but you know, but it's also, that period of being an icon is an extension of her work as something I like to think of as the charismatic figure. And that's really where the Republican queen comes from. And it becomes something that is offered to first ladies, and many first ladies have not availed themselves of that. But what we're talking about is, and we're back to the Queen Dolly, is she used herself and her personality as a tool of policy. So she created a persona. And I'm not going to say she dressed like a real queen, but she dressed like what ordinary Americans would imagine a queen would dress like.
She had some fabulous headdresses, I believe.
She had, oh my God. Well, fabulous everything. So, in fact, even a little bit outlandish, by the standards of the time. So she would dress in like ermine and satin. And those headdresses were like turbans with feathers, these plumes that wherever she was in her 300-person party, you could always see where she was because the plumes would be
as tiny as she was. She was projecting her stature via feathers.
Oh my gosh, feathers. And sometimes there'd be even something that would look a little bit like a crown.
Ooh.
You know, we were talking about skirting that line, Samantha, where you'd have a little embroidered crown or even a little, somebody noted with shock, a sparkling diadem on her head, which is like a little tiara. So
let's cut her some slack. Every girl wants to be a princess. Even if you escape monarchy, you still want to be the princess of wherever you're at.
and everybody wants a king or a queen in charge.
Yeah.
So, but understand the dynamic. So if you're an American and, you know, you're afraid of Napoleon Bonaparte, because at that point you're seeing what a charismatic figure with an army can do, how reassuring that you see James Madison standing at Dolly Madison's soirees, little tiny James, his little, you know, plain broadcloth. He's not going to start an army and take over a nation. He has no charisma. But at the same time, you see this magnificent creature who's imparting all of these wonderful messages of legitimacy and authority and reassurance, but she's a woman, so she's not scary. You're going to get that perfect balance. And so that charismatic figure who is a larger than life, beyond your own persona kind of figure, again, some first ladies like Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy did great with it. Others did not care to do it, but Dolly Madison kind of formed that that role for the first lady. So when she does come back and live in that beautiful little yellow house on Lafayette Square, she just steps into a new role as a charismatic figure.
So it sounds like your title of the book, A Perfect Union, is related to that union of Madison or James and Dolly as this complementary force in the politics of founding a nation.
Yeah, they are. So they are a perfect union that they're a political couple who have, if we talk about that official sphere and that unofficial sphere, they're the masters of their spheres. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody was smarter than James Madison. Nobody was more gifted than Dolly. The other union, though, is the nation. So, you know, when you're a historian and a biographer, you're always weighing like, Is it the person? Is it the circumstances, the historical circumstances in which a person finds themselves? Mm-hmm. And of course, the answer is always both. But had Dolly Madison not, had there not been a revolution, who would Dolly Madison be? Well, she would have probably ended up being the wife of a Virginia gentryman and, you know, special in her neighborhood or her family. But the fact that there was a nation and a capital that needed unifying, and in the case of the capital, it needed establishing because it was a pretty new capital as well. She really rose. The historical circumstances demanded that she rise using her gifts, which were authentic to her, but expanding on them and using them to create a nation that was more unified and a capital that's established. Don't forget that it's, you know, on Dolly's watch that the British burned the capital in 1814.
Hmm.
And there is a discussion from people who pretty much always hated Washington City that maybe it's time to move the capital to a more established city. This would have been, by the way, in hindsight, terrible, right? Because it would have certainly looked like defeat. Mm-hmm. It would have been horrible for the poor locals who had invested in Washington City. And it would just been bad for the nation. And I like to think that the fact that even Federalists crossed the party line to vote to keep the capital in D.C. was a testament to Dolly's efforts. And I don't mean that in a kind of lovely, kind way. I mean, Dolly helped build a town that was about nothing but politics. So if you had to move to New York or Philadelphia, you would have economic elites, social elites. There'd be all kinds of circles. In Washington City, all you needed to do was play politics and build those networks. And I think that in the end, the Congress said, we're staying in the city. It was because Dolly had, through her social sphere and her social networks and her patronage and her, all that, had built that political machine that was just, they couldn't walk away from it.
What stage did Dolly enter James Madison's life? And what had James Madison accomplished before? I correct myself because I recall in the intro to one of your books, you call them James and Dolly, and a departure from the traditional Madison and Dolly, as we refer to the famous men and the women behind them. What stage of his career did she enter? And is there anything that you think Madison, you know, couldn't have done or could not have achieved without her? What would you say is the most direct impact of Dolly's marriage to James that you would say is long-lasting?
So they met when James was middle-aged. He was in his 40s. She was in her 20s. And so you're asking me to be counterfactual, which is terrible for a historian, but I'm going to do it just for you and the society. If he had not met Dolly, it seems likely that he would not have married at all. I mean, he had married up to that point. He'd been disappointed in love before. Mm-hmm. And this made him very unusual because this was a culture where men married. And they married, and they married early and often. That is, you know, if somebody lost a spouse, this is true for women as well, but men, if they lost, they just married again. And it makes Madison and Jefferson outliers in their societies, because Jefferson was married, of course, lost his wife at a fairly early age and never married again. So let's imagine a James Madison that's not married. So let's imagine that James Madison does get himself elected president, comes to Washington, D.C., and is just the smartest man in the room, but that's it. And doesn't understand that these things have to happen, believes, as I said a little bit earlier, believes in attachment, believes in unity, but is not the guy that's going to bring people to the room. And so it's I won't go any farther than that. I won't say anything about the War of 1812. I'll just say he was just darn lucky to meet Dolly Madison when he did. And he, I must say, fell instantly in love with her. In fact, I hesitate to use the word lust, but I will. It seems wrong to talk about James Madison, but I think he fell completely in lust with her.
No one really probably ever would think of James Madison and lust in the same sentence. So I'm glad that you have this on the historical record.
we actually do have on the historical record, because he does write some rather saucy letters to a kinswoman of Dolly's. So or she writes about him. And it doesn't bear thinking, but they ended up being a very, very loving couple. And I do wonder why. So she was a widow at the time with a young son. She had a little money. She was very beautiful as a young woman. The fact that she had a young son and was a widow was not a detriment in the way that we might think about it, because it kind of showed that she was, fertile. So she could have had anybody she wanted. And then the question is why James. As it turns out, it was a great marriage as far as, it was not an equal marriage, because no marriage is equal in that time, but it was a great marriage. And he did allow her to fulfill her political gifts in a way that, for instance, John Quincy Adams did not allow Louisa Catherine to fulfill her political gifts. But I like to think that, she had a very rough early life, including moving away from her beloved Virginia and being sort of stuck in Philadelphia, where a succession of very bad things happened to her. And so I like to think that one of the reasons that she decided that she was going to go with this guy, who was, again, like 20 years older than she was because he was offering her not a political life, because at that point he and Jefferson were talking about retiring from politics, but a return to the Virginia gentry life that she had very golden memories about. And so I think she married him because he was a Virginian, the way she thought of herself as a Virginian.
Back to her roots.
Yes.
So in looking at, I guess, the first first ladies, you say, how important is the role of first lady in the leadership of the president? And what precedent did Dolley set as first lady?
So it's interesting that right from the start, there was an awareness of what to do about this position, even though it's unelected, obviously, and unofficial. And certainly George Washington and Martha Washington, Alexander Hamilton, all of those guys and Mrs. Washington understood that there was stuff they had to work out. And the stuff we're talking about exactly walks the line of this, how much aristocracy conveys legitimacy, how much is unrepublican. So Martha Washington constructs a persona for herself. She dresses in white, in a style very much evocative of a Roman matron. And as you know, for the founders, the Roman and Greek models of ancient Greek, ancient Rome, very important. So she kind of embodies this selfless, nation. She embodies this selfless Roman matron who's devoted to public service to the nation. They tried to figure out George Washington, John Adams, Hamilton, I think Jay as well, what kind of social events they were going to have, how they were going to receive visitors. And they constructed certain kinds of events, but they were all very formal, very small, rather stilted. And they were trying to construct what they thought of as ceremonies for a new republic. So it's not enough to say, oh, we're not going to have a king and a throne, and we're not going to have social events like receptions, and we're not going to have pomp and circumstance. You got to have something. You got to have ways of calling and ways of receiving. And so they're working that stuff out right from the start. Then we get Abigail Adams. And as you may know, the Massachusetts Historical Society is the home of the Adams Family Papers. So Abigail is very much a leading lady in my life. She was a different kind of first lady. She did a lot of the kind of ceremonial stuff that Martha Washington did. She didn't really innovate there, but she was a political partner. She was very politically savvy. I want to say if it's gendered here, she politicked more like a man than like a Dolley Madison. And she was a great sounding board for her husband. I'm a little ashamed to tell you that the policy over which she probably had the most influence was the Alien and Sedition Acts, which is not great, but it does show that she was this advisor to John Adams. And one of the reasons, by the way, I sort of alluded to this earlier, John Adams was so concerned with patronage that he kept his predecessor's cabinet, which was such a terrible idea. So I think Abigail would have always been an advisor and partner to her husband, but she really was, because he had nobody in that cabinet. They were all like talking behind his back and being very treacherous. So she modeled a different kind of first lady. And then Dolley comes along, and she's not, as far as we know, she's not having long political discussions, and she's not writing to her husband in the same way. Part of it is that they're not separated the way the Adamses were separated for many years. But she, you know, shows the power of the unofficial sphere. She demonstrates relationship to the house, her use of clothing and charisma. And all I can tell you is for many, many years, almost centuries, she becomes the standard by which other first ladies measure up. So poor Mary Todd Lincoln, who was not so good, Samantha, she tried. She tried to evoke Dolly. She was just a, she actually claimed kinship to Dolly because Mary's natal name was Todd and Dolly had married a Todd. I have never actually found any family link, but she tried to work that. But, you know, as late as Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy, she was a Dolly Madison fan.
I was going to say, Jackie sounds like the closest equivalent, our modern day Dolly Madison.
Yeah. Actually, I do have another, but yes. And I'm saying too that it was almost, I think she would probably have done many of the things she did anyway, but she was explicitly a Dolly Madison fan. She, even her work on the house, she found herself sort of echoing Dolly. I remember stories of maybe Mrs. Kennedy walking through the Octagon House, which was the White House after the White House was burned, sort of trying to commune with the spirit of Dolly. That may or may not be true. But I have to tell you, funnily enough, so my big biography of Dolly came out in 2006, and I would be asked who was the Dolly of 2006. And I used to say, without any kind of like humor, Bill Clinton. He was the Dolly Madison. And this was before Mrs. Clinton, you know, this is 2006. So it wasn't as though I thought this was going to happen, but.
So Bill, not about, Hillary.
No. Hillary's James Madison because she is the smartest person in the room. But I remember at this time that, you know, the Clintons, I was doing my research and stuff. People would talk about Bill Clinton as a person that when he talked to you, you felt like you were the most important person in the room. Mm. And oddly enough, I had people saying that in the early 1800s about Dolly. And also this idea of this larger than life charismatic figure, which, you know, Dolly would, people would talk about Dolly as beautiful. And I was thinking, you know, she's in her 40s, and 40s in those days was different than they are now.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. 60 is the 40 was the new 60.
Yeah, something like that. I'm thinking, and she was a plump. You know, people would actually mention her plumpness. and I thought, it's not that she was beautiful. It was that she had something almost beyond beauty. It was this charismatic.
Metaphysical attractiveness.
Yeah, it's gift of the gods. And I thought in 2006, that's what Bill Clinton had. He walked into a room and every, you know, that he had that thing. So I was making that joke long before. Yeah, exactly.
To be French and aristocratic.
Sure.
That's so interesting. So in conclusion, what would you say is Dolly Madison's lasting impact on America today?
So I would say two things. A practical hint for all you politicians out there. if you study Dolly Madison and you see the power of the unofficial sphere, you understand that one of the problems with Washington right now is we don't have that. So I had the pleasure of getting to know Cokie Roberts, the late Cokie Roberts. And she talked about when she was a girl and her family was in politics. This was an era where, and they were largely men, would come to Washington and they'd live there with their, again, wives and children. And these families did what Dolly would do, right? They would socialize. They would go to dinner. The kids would go swimming together. Wives would work on projects. And those were the days where you saw men work across the aisle because they got to know each other in this unofficial sphere, not as enemies, but as real human beings. And then I got to know a little bit of Chelsea Clinton, who, remember, she's now in the 90s. What happens in the 90s? Flights get really cheap in the 90s. And so suddenly these men aren't coming, and again, largely men, but women at this point too, are not coming with their families and buying houses or staying in houses and going to school and parties. They're flying in on Monday night. They're doing their business and they're flying out. And so what we're missing in Washington right now is this unofficial sphere where people can get to know each other and work together and get to know each other as a human being. So that would be the practical how-to that Dolly offers us, but I think there's something actually deeper. So when you look back at American history, we Americans are very attached to our history and our Constitution, and we take our history seriously. And if you look back and you look at just what men do, you see all these men standing up in Congress denouncing each other as basically an enemy of the state. They're, you know, shooting each other. They're beating each other with canes. They're on the floors of Congress, you know, on
physical altercations.
This hyper masculinity, right? And you might despair. You might think, well, this is our history. This is what's happening. This is where we're going. But if you look at women and you take seriously their words, their work, and you realize that you look at Dolly, who's bringing people in together and her cohort, making everybody behave, building bridges, not bunkers, working together. And this is why I call her the most modern politician of her time. She saw somehow, without all the fancy theories, that cooperation is and a two-party system is what's going to hold this country together. We can be heartened and say, ah, even when some of these guys are out there shooting each other, there was a group of people, of Americans, they happen to be women, who understood that cooperation, civility, kindness, even empathy were the things that were going to be the salvation of the system. So reassured by that, I would encourage us all to be Dolly Madison and move forward into the future, building those bridges and not the bunkers.
I love that, bridges, not bunkers. It sounds like the vibe that we should aspire to in our Washingtonian salons is more Madisonian as opposed to Jeffersonian.
I would concur.
Excellent. Thank you again, Dr. Alger, for joining us today for another episode of the FedSoc Films podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Our guest today is Dr. Catherine Alger, president of the Massachusetts Historical Society and author of many books on Dolly Madison. You can check out the film Madison and the Fight for the Constitution on YouTube, Facebook, or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe for more episodes of the FedSoc Films podcast. If you like this episode, please leave us a review. As always, the Federalist Society doesn't take any positions on the issues discussed. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.